A dozen.
You're listening to This Week in Radio News. Radio news about radio waves, radio art, and more. I'm Tom Rowe, your host, and we'll travel across the ether to hear what's going on in radio news. Federal Communications Commission's recent ruling allowing net neutrality may give some consumers the idea that companies can't pay more money to create fast lanes on the Internet for certain services. Corporations have many ways around those rules, John Bergmeier and Shiva Stella in Slate.com report. Comcast, for one, is refusing to sell its own video programming to other online video providers such as Netflix. The HBO Go app launched March 3rd for the PlayStation 4, but not for Comcast Xfinity subscribers who already pay for HBO. Quote, if you try to access HBO Go on a Comcast internet connection using Verizon-provided credentials, you can. But if you try to access HBO Go on a Verizon internet connection using Comcast-provided credentials, you can't, unquote, the Slate story says. Last year, it was reported that Comcast had blocked people with Rokus from accessing HBO Go and Showtime. Slate says Comcast also refuses to authenticate Hulu, even though it shares Hulu ownership. Generally, if a company will pay enough, companies such as Comcast will allow authentication. If not, consumers are out of luck. This happens on the radio, too. Edward Erickson Jr. in Baltimore's City Paper recently reported about how local non-commercial NPR affiliate WYPR 88.1 FM regularly blurs the line between programming and underwriting. Quote, programming produced by a Johns Hopkins public relations professional, the CEO of the National Aquarium, a pair of local restaurateurs, and a prominent local economist, all whose corporate employers underwrite programming on the station, blend in with work by radio journalists and talk show hosts with no other allegiance or means of support, unquote, Erickson wrote. On one WYPR show, Baltimore's Future, host David Warnock touts the work of recipients of grants dispensed by the Warnock Foundation, its subsidiary Baltimore Social Innovation Journal, and nonprofits he chairs. Warnock donates more than $200,000 a year to the Warnock Foundation, and the weekly four-minute show contains no disclaimers about his finance company or its many corporate clients, and was, until recently, underwritten by the Warnock Foundation. Does that sound like pay-to-play? Current FCC rules actually allow pay-to-play if the payment is disclosed at the time of the airplay. Record companies could, right now, pay radio stations to play certain songs if they disclose that fact as they play the music. But no radio station wants to come on and say, that Beyoncé track was paid for by Columbia Records. Radio broadcasters in the record industry would like to change that, however. Last November, the Radio Broadcasters Coalition, nine corporations that own most commercial radio stations in the United States, filed a petition with the FCC seeking a class waiver of the commission's requirement that broadcasters air sponsorship identification announcements at the time sponsored material is broadcast. Instead, the coalition wants radio broadcasters airing sponsored music or sports programming to be permitted to air less frequent on-air announcements with enhanced online disclosures. The FCC is asking for comments on this proposal on or before April 13th and reply comments on or before May 12th. All filings must reference MB docket number 1552. You can search the FCC's website, fcc.gov, for an easy link to file comments yourself. The American Radio Relay League reports that, according to an internal Federal Communications Enforcement Bureau memorandum, the Bureau wants to cut two-thirds of its field offices and eliminate nearly one-half of its field agents from 63 to 33. The March 10th memo says the Bureau would keep offices in New York City, Columbia, Maryland, Chicago, Atlanta, Miami, Dallas, Los Angeles, and San Francisco. Instead, the Bureau would create a so-called flexible tiger team of field agents it could deploy as needed with necessary equipment in other cities, initially including Kansas City, Salt Lake City, Phoenix, Seattle, San Juan, Puerto Rico, Anchorage, Honolulu, and Billings, Montana. John Anderson at DIYmedia.net, a site that tracks pirate radio enforcement, writes that less than 2 weeks ago, FCC Managing Director John Wilkins was asked about this issue at a congressional hearing regarding the FCC's budget. Representative Yvette Clark, Democrat from New York, said she recently received complaints from New York City area broadcasters about many pirate stations and asked about funding in the FCC's budget to fight pirate radio. Quote, the only way we can manage is to find out where is the highest density of need and how we can deploy the people and the resources that we have against that, unquote, Wilkins said. Representative Michael Pompeo, Republican from Kansas, followed up. quote, I asked a direct question. You gave a generic response. Is there a recommendation to close field offices for the FCC and relocate people to your headquarters, unquote. No final recommendation on that, Wilkins replied. The broadcast industry is not happy about the leaked memo. Quote, the ARRL is concerned that there is already no sense of urgency in the FCC's enforcement activities targeting spectrum polluters, such as utilities with noisy power lines or the few violators in our own ranks, unquote. ARRL CEO David Sumner, K1ZZ, said, quote, it is troubling to see recommendations for such drastic reductions in the Commission's geographic footprint and the number of field agents at a time when the field staff is facing ever-increasing challenges, unquote. Radio Inc., an industry trade magazine, wrote, quote, considering the data showing that the FCC has taken fewer actions against pirates in recent years, and now the confirmation of the FCC considering downsizing of the field office personnel, the worry for licensed broadcasters has to be that this perfect storm may lead to even more problems and fewer actions against pirates, unquote. And while the FCC's enforcement efforts may be scaling back, some local police are now using AM radios to find marijuana grow rooms, EDN.com reports. The grow rooms use large 1,000-watt high-pressure sodium or metal halide lamps driven by electronic ballast. Many of the ballasts are imported from China, and the manufacturers are not complying with FCC emission standards, which means the lights produce radio frequency interference, RFI, which is often heard by local radio amateurs as static. The ARRL's lead RFI investigator, Mike Gruber, says the group made formal complaints to the FCC dated March 2014 about the lights. Gruber also conducted tests on three electronic ballasts and found peaks as high as 50 dBs over the limit in the range of 6 to 8 megahertz, with lower peaks at 14, 18, and 21 megahertz, and also in the AM broadcast band, where the police are now tuning their radios to detect grow rooms from as far away as 2,500 feet. The FCC's Enforcement Bureau would usually investigate this sort of interference, but apparently the cutbacks may mean the radio interference stays. Full disclosure, John Anderson is on Wave Farm's board. Federal Communications Commission Chair Tom Wheeler testified before the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee on the FCC's relationship with the Obama administration on March 17th. The hearing was about the FCC's 3-2 approval along party lines of net neutrality, rules designed to prohibit Internet service providers from blocking or discriminating against legal content moving through their networks. Republicans focused their questions on the theory that President Obama ordered or coordinated the Democrats on the commission to favor the rules that they previously did not all support. Committee Chair Representative Jason Chavez, Republican from Utah, opened explaining those views.
We will examine the series of events resulting in the highly controversial vote to use Title II to regulate Internet like a public utility. In May of 2014, the FCC issued a notice of proposed rulemaking concerning Internet regulation that indicated broadband and mobile services would remain classified under Title I. Public statements made by Chairman Wheeler and communications received by this committee demonstrate that this was Chairman's intent during this time period. In October 2014 and after the FCC's public comment period ended, media reports indicate that Chairman Wheeler intended to finalize a hybrid approach to that continued to classify broadband and mobile Internet services under Title I. Just days later, President Obama appeared in a YouTube video calling for a radically different proposal. Full Title II reclassification, similar to a utility or a telephone company. Emails provided to the committee by the FCC suggest that this came as a major surprise to the FCC staff, including Mr. Wheeler. On January 7th, Chairman Wheeler announced the FCC would radically alter course and reclassify broadband and mobile services under Title II. I'm sure much will be made about the 4 million comments that were made, but they were not made in the context of fully changing this to Title II. The FCC adopted the rule change on February 26th in a 3-2 vote. The lack of transparency surrounding the open Internet rulemaking process leaves us with a lot of questions. This is a fact-finding hearing. This committee remains committed to ensuring full transparency across government. And I look forward to hearing more from Chairman Wheeler today.
Minority Chair Representative Elijah Cummings, Democrat from Maryland, countered that the 4 million comments from the public weighed more than the single comment from President Obama.
Supporters of this new rule contend that ISPs should not be allowed to discriminate based on content. They believe ISPs should be required to act like phone companies, controlling the pipes that make up the Internet, but not what flows through them. Consumers, social media entities, and companies like Facebook, Netflix, and Google favor open Internet policy because they do not want to be charged higher prices to provide their services. The question before the committee is not which policy we may prefer, but whether the process used by the FCC to adopt the rule was appropriate. Republicans who oppose the new rule allege that President Obama exerted undue influence on the process, but we have seen no evidence to support this allegation.
Chavez then questioned Wheeler on any coordination with the White House.
And so you had multiple meetings with the White House. They came to visit you, and we're supposed to believe that there was only one discussion about this? Is that still your testimony?
They came, let me be really clear, they came once to meet with me and filed an ex parte, at which time I was told, as the ex parte says, the President is going to make an announcement on a couple days later, and he's going to endorse Title II. That's all I knew. The other meetings at the White House, you know, I was there on trade, I was there on national security issues, I was there on spectrum, I was there on auctions, I was there on E-rate. I mean, there are numerous issues.
Chavez also announced at the hearing that the FCC's Inspector General has launched an investigation into how the agency's net neutrality rules were crafted. Amy Schatz at Recode reports, quote, the FCC's Inspector General isn't exactly known for investigating the conduct of commissioners, so this might not amount to much. FCC investigators mostly focus on stopping fraud in the FCC's multi-billion-dollar federal subsidy program for phone and internet services, unquote. You can see the full hearing on C-SPAN or at newsroom.wgxc.org or newsroom.free103.9.org. Paying all the bills at any sort of radio station can be difficult in this multimedia age. The studio of Berkeley Liberation Radio was broken into and robbed March 2nd, and now the legendary pirate radio station has a GoFundMe campaign to get back on the air. As of March 18th, the station had raised $1,250 of the $2,000 it says it needs to get back on the air. The station was founded originally as Free Radio Berkeley in the early 1990s by Stephen Dunifer, the Johnny Appleseed of the micro-radio movement. Legal stations also have many costs, especially streaming their signals online. Paul Rimsmondale at Radio Survivor reports that Sound Exchange, the nonprofit organization that collects so-called mechanical royalties for recorded music, just reached a settlement with National Public Radio and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting on the rates that affiliated public and community stations will owe from 2016 to 2020. The details of the agreement have not been made public yet, and the settlement must still be approved by the Copyright Royalty Board. Last October, Sound Exchange also reached a settlement with the College Broadcasters Incorporated. Rimsmondale also reports he spoke with another writer who said that a pirate station had received notice from ASCAP and BMI demanding that the station pay up for its internet stream. Last year, East Village Radio, which began as a pirate station in 2003 and then went just online, closed because, quote, licensing fees and internet costs, unquote, were too large for the station to cover. Recently, new apps have emerged that make it easier than ever for anyone to start their own streaming online radio station. Mixlr and Fradio, which was launched this week, both let anyone use their phones as a transmitter with just a few touches to start broadcasting. The question is now if BMI and ASCAP will be tracking down each user who is playing music for royalty payments. Already, a quick look through Mixlr's streams show many traditional radio stations using the app to stream their signals. Both apps also make it very simple for anyone to broadcast royalty-free events such as town council meetings, and local lectures, or political debates, so not all streams must pay these fees. StoryCorps, an American nonprofit organization whose mission is to record, preserve, and share the stories of Americans, also launched their own app this week, allowing oral historians and other interviewers to share their audio with the U.S. Library of Congress on the website StoryCorps.me and on social media sites such as Facebook and SoundCloud. David Oxenford at the Broadcast Law blog reports that the Federal Communications Commission will hold an auction for 131 commercial FM channels July 23rd. Most frequencies are in Texas, and the minimum bid range from $1,500 to $75,000. 18 frequencies are left over from previous auctions, so they might go without bids again. Most are in very rural areas. Columbia, Missouri, and Maysville, Georgia command the top minimum bids. The FCC has made non-commercial FM frequencies available in recent years, including two rounds of low-power FM stations and one full-power non-commercial window, and those did not require money, just filling out an application by a nonprofit group and competing in a scoring system among other nonprofits. These commercial licenses are more of a capitalistic outing. Winning bids get construction permits to build out radio stations. Oxenford guesses that applications would be due in May, and the upfront payments of at least the minimum bid would be required in June. Quote, if you win the auction and decide that you can't really find a transmitter site, then you may well be on the hook for the full amount of the bid even if you don't build the station, unquote, Oxenford writes. Full applications with the location of transmitter sites would be due about a month after the auction, he also guesses, based on past FCC actions. The FCC is also taking comments through April 1st on its auction procedures, so anyone who does not like the process can suggest other ways the FCC could make these frequencies available. Refer to Auction 98 in your comments and follow the link at FCC.gov website. So joining us via Skype right now is Ana Ramos. Am I pronouncing it right, Ana?
Ana Ramos, yeah.
Ana Ramos from Radio Web MACBA, RWM, from the Museum of Contemporary Art in Barcelona. I thought, Ana, you could first give our listeners a background about what is Radio Web MACBA.
Well, it's a project that's been going on for almost 9 years, so we've got quite a long background, and I think we might have produced about 500 podcasts so far. So it's been a long-term effort and also a very interesting journey so far. And basically, it's an online radio focused on different issues, starting from philosophy, art, but also exploring sound-related stuff.
Museums seem to have a problem displaying sound. The sound bleeds together. People have to wear headphones sometimes, or they have to stand under a little disc or something. Is this a way to get a virtual museum or a radio museum, sort of?
It began more as an experiment. Back in 2006, we started hearing about podcasting and everything. And since the museum was a hub for a constant flux of very interesting people who was coming and giving lectures or organizing shows and stuff, Sonia López, who is the head of digital media at the museum, just made this proposal. And at the beginning, it was something that was a bit more related to what was happening in the museum. And in 2008, we just realized that it really made sense to expand the area of exploration and our area of interest to other fields such as music, sound art, or even sometimes radio art. So we started working on other lines of investigation, lines of research, and this is where we are at right now.
And what typically would people hear if they tune into Radio Web MACBA?
I would say there's a very varied amount of things. As I mentioned in the beginning, you can find philosophy-related podcasts or art-related podcasts, interview with artists, curators, and lecturers. But also, you can also find very interesting research efforts on sound. We've had so far a series about the collapse of tonality in the 20th century, for instance, by Chris Cutler. Or we've had a series on sound appropriationism by John Lederer. We've also had a series on music, on generative music by Joe Gilmore and Mark Fell. So there's many different things that you can find here. But one of the things that all these projects share is that it's a very slow cooking process, that there's a very in-depth research in everything we do, and in the end, What we are offering, or what you can find in this project, is I would like to think that it's something that it's not easy to find anywhere else. But that's my, I mean, that's what I wish you can find there.
And what is the audience like compared to the physical building in Barcelona, where you have people coming in and looking at things or listening to things? Here, I guess you have people from all over the world, and maybe you don't even know how many people are listening
Yeah, I mean, the audience is I would say it's different, but there's of course coincidence in the audience. According to our stats, I think 75% of our audience is international. So it means that we have many listeners abroad, and the rest is from Spain. So as you can see by these numbers, it's there's quite a lot of interest in the project outside Catalonia and Spain.
And likewise, the artists you work with are from all over the world as well.
Yeah, exactly. That's also one of the important things, or one of the things that we try to take care about. We really like to work with artists in the project, not only international artists, but local artists. We like to create this special situation where artists and as I mentioned, philosophers or curators are together in one place, and they share experiences or they share thoughts or they share their discourse, and then together with them, then we create this podcast. So in the end, I would like to think that this is there's some of these invisible things are transferred to the audio somehow. Also, most of our producers are musicians or sound artists, so they have a special sensibility when they are working with audio, which always takes you to places that you would not imagine in the end. And I think that's what it gives the project this special touch. But that's wishful thinking. It's the listener, the one who has to judge.
And many of these projects, or some of the projects, have artists that work specifically with radio or use radio in their work, or the works are about radio. Is that right?
Yeah. In some of our projects, this has happened, and it's inevitable, because when you're exploring the medium and you're exploring sound art or music, eventually radio art comes into the equation. But I always like to explain that being a museum and working with audio, it doesn't mean that you're making sound art or having an online radio and working with podcasts. It doesn't mean that you're doing radio art. I mean, both radio art and sound art, for us, or at least for me, they have to have a special conditions, and they have to have their own context. That doesn't mean that eventually we can work in a project that you can consider radio art. But just by being a museum or the online radio of a museum, it doesn't mean that you are doing that. We're doing many things, and some things are, as I mentioned, in-depth interviews. Some others are sound essays. And eventually, I would like to think that sometimes sound art can happen, or sometimes radio art can happen. But most of the times, it's something in between, something in the edges, it's an uncharted territory, and that's what makes it interesting for us.
And Ana Ramos, the curator from Radio Web Macba, the radiophonic project at the Museum of Contemporary Art Barcelona, can you give out the website if people want to listen, and tell us about any other projects coming up that you might want to mention?
Okay, but I'll try to do it the best I can. So the website, and correct me if my spelling is not okay, is rwm.macba.cat.
That's right. rwmmacba.cat.
Exactly. Some other projects. It really depends on your interests, but One of the ones I'm enjoying most is Chris Cutler's Probe series, which explores the collapse of tonality in the 20th century. His approach is a very interesting research. And one of the things that I like most is that the sources he mentions are not only academic sources or release stuff, but he does a lot of research on YouTube. And so it's one of those things where you mix an amazing background. He's been doing music forever, and he has played with almost everyone that's interesting in improvisation music so far. So, but I really like his approach because he mixes lectures with sound that he finds sometimes in YouTube, and also very obscure CDs or music he has. And every episode is focused on a subject. And so far we've published 11 episodes, and every episode has two episodes, so it's 22 podcasts on the series. So, and it's everyone, and in every single one I discover new music, which is something that, at least for me, it's amazing.
There are so many things on your website, and I think we should also mention your Twitter feed if people want to subscribe to that. Is Radio Web Makba?
Yeah, yeah. There we just anything that is in front of us, it's there.
Yes, it's always usually enjoy following the links that you send out.
Oh, thanks so much. It's nice to see that there's people there.
Paying attention, yes. Yeah. It doesn't just go into the ether.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Ana Ramos, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks to you for doing this. It's very important for us to just give space to, or give another space for these things we do and share it with people.
Great. Well, thank you for Skyping in.
Thank you.
The preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.